The views and opinions expressed by the following program are those of the host, guest, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station or the Webster Rock Hill Ministries, its management, or other host or underwriting sponsors. Programs presented on KWRHLP are for educational and entertainment purposes only. Views which are presented are for educational purposes only and are not intended to treat, diagnose, or claim any cure of disease or condition.
This is Amanda LaPlante, and you're listening to Get Real to Heal on KWRHLP 92.9 FM. And with me today is board-certified cardiologist Dr. Michael Twyman, also a biohacking expert, and he is going to give us some fantastic tips on something that I need a little help with, sleep. Before we jump into that, I want to say this Get Real to Heal broadcast is underwritten by AFC Urgent Care across from Brentwood City Hall at South Brentwood Boulevard in Litzinger. I talk a lot about preventive care measures on this show, but there are situations that can't be avoided and absolutely require a physician's attention. AFC Urgent Care is the perfect place to visit for those needs. They have a physician on staff, and AFC Urgent Care handles non-life-threatening injuries and illnesses. They can also perform x-rays and even lab services in-house, so you can visit them 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. weekdays and 8 to 5 on weekends. AFCUrgentCare.com/Brentwood for more info. Those situations happen. Correct. Yeah, and being a cardiologist, you deal in all kinds of those situations, I would imagine.
In my former life as a conventional cardiologist, yeah, I saw a lot more of that acute care stuff, but not trying to focus a little bit more on the prevention.
Yeah, and I'm happy to be a part of that mission.
Yes.
So your new practice, Apollo Cardiology, tell us a little more.
Sure. So Apollo Cardiology opened up in August of this year. It's located in downtown Clayton. It focuses on heart attack and stroke prevention.
Okay. And a lot of the things that you talk about, right, are biohacking type scenarios. So tell us a little bit about what biohacking means for people that may not have caught you on here before.
Sure. So biohacking is a term coined by Dave Asprey, the Bulletproof executive, so the Bulletproof coffee guy. And his definition is roughly, you know, how do you optimize your external and internal environment to adjust your biology to have optimal performance, you know, mental function and physical function.
Yeah. And so for anyone who's listening and hasn't heard Dr. Twyman on the show before, he's been on a few times. He's a great friend of the show and provides a lot of wonderful information. Catch him, catch those old episodes on soundcloud.com/getrealtoheal or facebook.com/getrealtoheal. And you should also follow him on Instagram. It's awesome. You put a lot of good information out.
Thank you. Yeah. Dr. Twyman on Instagram. So
awesome. All right. So today we're going to talk about sleep.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I will say is sometimes elusive for me. And I've been working through some of these awesome tips that you've shared with our clients. I am a health coach at Apollo Cardiology working with Dr. Twyman and honored to do so. And I'm constantly learning new things. So where do you want to start with this big topic?
Sure. So sleep is something that's not always the sexiest of topics, but it's something that I got interested in a couple of years ago, you know, mainly through my experience with, you know, when I got into the biohacking world. And the story goes is that I was going to fly to Thailand. It's about a 12-hour flight. And I was trying to figure out how to adjust for the jet lag that I'd be exposed to, and came upon Dave Asprey's articles about wearing these funny glasses that I'm currently wearing. So I know for the people on Facebook, maybe they can see it, but I have a yellow tint pair of glasses on. I also have the ones I actually wear on the plane that are red tinted. These glasses block certain wavelengths of light that go into your eye, and that helps reset your circadian rhythm, your 24-hour cycle. So potentially the jet lag won't be so bad when you get over to the other side. It worked, and I went back to the States once the trip is over and really went into a deep dive of how circadian biology worked.
Okay. And I got to say, I pull out my red glasses for every single client that I see, of course, and let them try them on. And I had them out yesterday, and she put them on and she was like, oh, wow. Oh, these are great. These are so relaxing.
Correct. I mean, they just kind of start quieting the brain down and getting it ready for sleep.
Yeah, it's amazing. They've made a big difference for me. Okay, so you come back and you did a deep dive on circadian rhythm. And what are some of the things that struck you immediately? What did you learn?
So the circadian rhythm is your 24-hour cycle, and it's mainly programmed by one of two things. One, it's the light that enters your eye, and the second is the timing of your meals. And I think we've talked a little bit about that on previous episodes, but you know, for a good review, go look at the Circadian Code book by Dr. Panda. It explains everything about time-restricted eating, trying to eat your food in a 12-hour or less window per day. If your gut and liver have, you know, some time off, your sleep tends to improve. So that's one way to kind of adjust your circadian rhythm. But the main one we'll focus on today is the light. And I follow this fairly routinely, is that, you know, I will see every sunrise, because that morning light resets that trigger every day in your brain. There's a thing called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the SCN, that's behind your eyes. It's like your master GPS clock. It gets reset by the light that enters your eye. So the morning sunlight is what starts it. You start making your hormones throughout the day. So you want to be outside during the day to keep kind of getting that GPS clock to tell your body what time of day it is, how to make your hormones. And then once it's dark, your body will start releasing melatonin from the eyes that have been, melatonin's being made during the day. It gets stored up in the brain, but it only gets released at night after about 3 to 4 hours of darkness. So the better you control your light environment, the better you control your circadian rhythms.
Yeah, and so this is a big problem for people in the modern world, but really, if we think about it, it makes so much sense that people were synced up to the rhythms of nature and the light patterns in nature. And I love in coaching sessions, I'm able to get people to slow down and breathe and relax and start tapping into that kind of primal aspect that's all, it's within all of us. It just makes sense.
Sure, and it was only until 1879 when the light bulb got invented. The majority of people lived an outside existence. They were spending 80-90% of their time outside, very few, time inside, only when they were sleeping. Now it's flipped and people are spending 80-90% of the time inside, and they're basically getting programmed by the artificial light instead of the way Mother Nature intended.
And what are some of the effects that that's having on heart health?
It's tremendous. So, if you don't sleep well, you don't repair yourself. So when you sleep, especially when you get into the REM, the rapid eye movement levels of sleep, that's when your body's repairing the damage that's happened during the day. So, if you're not getting deep enough sleep, you're basically working on old parts all the time, and inflammation keeps building up. So inflammation is your immune system turned on and staying on. So if you have an infection or an injury, you want your immune system turned on, but you want it to shut off. If you have chronic inflammation, then, more risk of getting an autoimmune condition or, malignancies, Alzheimer's. So sleep is when all that inflammation gets cleared from the body.
Yeah. Yeah. And so many diseases are rooted in chronic inflammation, which of course diet and lifestyle has a major effect on. And of course, one of those pillars is sleep. So just again, reiterating the importance there. All right. So where did you want to go with this next? I have a few ideas, but I think you have a few as well.
I'll let you start.
All right. Well, I do want to touch back on, you said if there's not food in the digestive tract, right, people can get better sleep. And I know that's not our focus for today's episode, but I think it's important to touch on that again, because I know so many people, my husband, who are late night snackers.
Sure.
And it's important to explain why that's an issue.
Your liver and gut literally have little clocks in them, and they get triggered when nutrients come into the system. And they need about 3 to 4 hours before those clocks turn off. And so I sometimes use the example of Home Depot or Lowe's. They're always getting deliveries. If they don't know if they're going to get delivered, they stay open. So the liver and gut are waiting for food to come in. And it takes that 3 to 4 hours of nothing coming in before they flip the switch when you start going into fat burning mode. So if you're a super healthy person, it's probably not as big a deal. But if you're sick and you're trying to reverse a disease, you need to be more tight on your timing of your meals. And so if you can stop eating 3 to 4 hours before you normally go to bed, the gut gets that signal and you'll start making the sleep hormones appropriately, and your body can start going better into fat burning mode for most cases.
And I know a lot of people this time of year, with it being around the holidays, are really struggling with that aspect of things. I talk to a lot of my coaching clients are coming in, they're going, but I have this holiday party and I really want to, but man, the cost sometimes, especially
correct,
if you have a chronic condition, is just far greater than.
Correct. And it's, it is challenging, and it's one of those things that society sometimes is not set up to maintain your circadian rhythms optimally, and you have to decide what's important for you. So sometimes you got to go against what society is normally doing. So if you can, possibly move your parties up to, a brunch or a mid-afternoon type of event.
Yeah, that's a great tip. Absolutely. Okay. So, the other thing I wanted to touch on is our livers are a little overworked these days, right? And
yes.
So giving a little bit more of a break, pretty important.
Correct. And I'm obviously not a hepatologist or liver specialist, but your liver is one of the major detox organs, and your body is pretty smart. If you get out of its way, it usually can repair itself, but it needs time to do that. So stop overtaxing the liver so it can do its job.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the other tips that you have shared with me that are just really, just good sense. For instance, making the bedroom kind of a sanctuary, right?
Right. So usually we'll talk to patients about having a sleep cave or a place that you're going to recover. Your bedroom should be for one of two things. It's to go to sleep, for sex. You shouldn't be, you know, working in your bed, watching TV in bed, listening to music in bed, because then you're conditioning your brain that other activities happen other than recovering. So I tend to recommend patients keep the room as dark as they can. Ideally, you shouldn't be able to see your hand in front of your face. So if it's a lot of artificial light coming in from outside, then get a pair of blackout curtains. You know, if you actually still can't do that, then get a nice eye mask and, you know, block out the light. And then temperature is important. So typically, you know, temperature varies as your age, what's more optimal, but ballpark about 68 degrees or cooler. People tend to sleep better as your metabolism slowing down at night.
Gotcha. And, you know, there's another in the notes here. I had the powerofwhenquiz.com jotted down and talking about chronotypes. I'd love for you to share a little bit about that.
So I'm not an expert in that. And I've, you know, gone to that website and I've have the chronotype where I think I'm a lion, where, you know, I can, you know, get up in the morning time and, you know, function and do what I need to do. But the greatest majority of people have a normal chronotype. It's more the kind of the outliers that are really the super early birds and the people that are really the night owls. But that website gives you an idea of, you know, where you should try to reset your circadian rhythms. And that's probably the number one sleep tip for today is, you know, have a consistent bedtime and consistent wake up time. You know, if you're always kind of switching around the time you wake up or going to bed, you'll get what's known as social jet lag, and your body can only reset about an hour a day. So if you're kind of messing around on the weekends and going to bed 3 hours later than normal, you're really putting yourself behind the eight ball, getting back to optimal health.
Again, a huge challenge this time of year.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So resets about an hour a day.
It can. So that's why jet lag is so challenging. You know, actual like flying in a plane jet lag. So when you're flying from here to eastbound, you're, you know, basically compressing the day. So your circadian rhythms don't shift as fast as that. So, but now it's more and more people are getting this social jet lag where they're, you know, maybe going to bed early during the weekdays, but they're staying up 3 or 4 hours later at night. And typically most people, if they're staying up later, you know, they're probably doing stuff that isn't always as optimal for their health. You know, they're probably consuming more alcohol than they need. They're, you know, indulging in more foods and eating later at night and things that are going to really kind of affect their sleep. You know, if it's a one-off type thing, that's probably not a big deal. But if it's becoming more of a habit, then you start having more issues.
Gotcha. Okay, so speaking of jet lag, I have a trip coming up I'm really excited about. I'm going to Hawaii. And then when I get back, I've got 2 days and I'm going to Puerto Rico. Okay. So how does one accommodate for that?
Yeah, that going to Puerto Rico wouldn't be easy because they're basically on East Coast time, so it's not going to be a big shift there. But
so going forward, not going, a big deal. Yeah, going so, backwards.
Correct. Okay. So flying westbound, for the most part, isn't as challenging because the days are longer, and you're exposed to more light when you get over to the other side. So when you fly to Hawaii, you'll be fine, but flying from Hawaii back, it's going to mess you up for a couple of days. So the kind of the quick and dirty is, you know, the second you get on the plane, pretend you're in wherever your location is going to be. So if it's supposed to be nighttime and you're sleeping there, sleep on the plane or put on your glasses that tell your brain it's nighttime. That's the number one tip, is control your light environment. Then your meals. There's some school thought that you probably should try to consider an extended fast. If you're healthy enough to fast, is don't put anything in the system so the gut and the liver can reset once you get to your location and you eat the food when it should be breakfast, lunch, or dinner in that location. That'll help set the cycle better.
Now, when would it not be good for someone to fast?
If you're chronically ill, you may not want to do that because you might put more undue stress on the body than the benefit is at that point. So, you know, fasting does have a role, but you need to work with a kind of qualified coach or healthcare professional, you know, to get the optimal benefits out of fasting. So if it's a short fast, fine. But if you're playing around with like 24, 36 hour fast, seek medical opinions first.
So we're talking about, if in this jet lag situation, you're talking about that long of a fast, right?
Potentially.
Wow.
I might, you know, personally as a biohacker, I've done it once when I was flying to Italy. I didn't eat anything for, you know, a long time. And when I got there, it was lunchtime in Italy, ate lunch. And then, you know, I think that the jet lag was a little bit less, but you know, I was willing to do that myself. But like I said, for somebody else to do it, you need to kind of know what your health situation is or health goals are before you kind of really blanketly go fasting.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now, but fasting is an interesting topic. I do want to touch on it real briefly, mm-hmm. then, since it sounds like you know a fair amount about it because you've looked into it for your own practices. So, you know, people used to use fasting, we'll say medically, I guess, in different, yeah. Yeah. So like in Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, a lot of times they're talking about fasting, especially during times of illness, et cetera. So can you clear that up a bit?
So fasting just allows your body to get back to the process of doing this autophagy and apoptosis. And autophagy is just a fancy word for recycling. And apoptosis is a Greek word for self-suicide. So your body is constantly turning itself over. And if you give the body time to do that, things will tend to run better. So fasting is that kind of period. And then there's different things. mTOR is a substance that gets made that helps with muscle protein synthesis. But when you're fasting, then mTOR goes down. So there's definitely benefits of fasting. But again, it's all based off the health goal. So, you know, if it's weight loss, it's a different thing versus if it's, you know, for mental clarity, if it's, you know, you just need to know what you're getting yourself into.
Well, and I think it's so interesting because, you know, we can observe this in mammals in the wild or, you know, I have a dog and he had a stomach ache and he just fasted for a while. And I thought, gosh, is he okay? Is something wrong? But it was just an instinct that he had. It was built in. It was internal. And I think that, you know, we've just gotten so used to in our society suppressing those internal instincts. And getting back to that is really, to my mind, a lot of what biohacking is about, finding modern science ways to explain things that people really were doing by nature.
Right. Yeah. Just reconnecting with nature and doing it the way it had been doing for, you know, thousands of years until we started inventing all this artificial light and technology.
We got so much smarter.
Yes.
So what are some of the other sleep tips that you wanted to share today? Because I've got some other thoughts for a tangent.
Yeah, let's go for the tangent first.
All right. I love a tangent. Okay. So, you know, speaking of mammalian instincts, if you will, it's cold outside. And you were talking about an internal mechanism to help people to be warmer, thermogenesis, right?
Right.
I'd love for you to share some more information on that.
Okay. So cold thermogenesis is essentially a process where you're adapting to the cold so that you can turn your white fat into brown fat. The brown fat is brown because it has more mitochondria. The mitochondria are the things that are in your cells that make energy. But the mitochondria also, if they're energy inefficient, they release heat. So you can think of it like a radiator. So people who live on the equator typically have very tight mitochondria. It's a little bit more complex than that, but if I just were tight, basically they're very energy efficient. They don't waste heat. If you're living up north, you're Scandinavian, your mitochondria are more leaky because you got to heat your body up, so they're not as energy efficient. So there's a way you can use this diver's reflex that's built into all mammals to retrain your body to be able to adapt to the cold. So it's always built into people. Nobody, but, you know, many people in St. Louis say, like, I hate the cold. I can't tolerate the cold. I'm not a cold person. Yeah, that was me until like 2 years ago. And then I've been reading a lot of Dr. Jack Cruz's information, especially about the cold thermogenesis. And, you know, he has his own protocol, so you can go to search for Dr. Cruz on his website and he can kind of walk you through it. But, you know, but if you adapt to the cold, your body makes more brown fat. It's usually kind of on your backside of your neck and upper spine. And that basically will make it like a furnace. So a little bit back to the fasting is that, you know, when you're sleeping at night, you're fasting. You're basically burning energy from your stored up fat for the most part. If you have cold thermogenesis all dialed in, you're going to burn off a lot of excess body fat at night that you don't need.
Okay. I've got a question then. So, sure. You know, we talk about like, you know, I want to say brown fat, right? I think that's what we've been told it is, but like the fat around the belly or on the back, you know, that is problematic and can lead to heart issues. This isn't the same thing.
Not the same thing. So the belly fat is more the inflammatory fat. So the fat that's around your midsection or your organs, it's basically the location where your body stores all the toxins. So the solution to pollution is dilution is the chemistry term. So, you know, when you have something toxic and your body can't get rid of it, it shoves it in your fat cells and says, we'll deal with this later. But if you never shut off the sink that's putting it out, you know, that toxin does keep building up in the fat cells. So your body's, you know, this is one reason some people have an idea that obesity is actually an inflammatory condition. It's recovering or it's protecting the body from all the toxins it's been exposed to.
I've certainly seen that as, and, you know, we have some clients who have been losing a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. I've seen that with some of my other coaching clients, you know, they start to lose weight and they go through almost like a Herx reaction. In a way, or just some kind of a toxic burden is going on there, and so they're looking for ways to detox and support the liver and so on, which makes sense. Correct. When you explain it that way.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So I want to also touch on, you know, you've got something in your notes about cell phone alarms.
Sure. So back to kind of the sleep cave analogy, and that you know, your cave would not have had a cell phone sitting right by your head. So your mitochondria are like little sensors that are always scanning the environment. the cell phone is essentially a jammer to those mitochondria signals for some people. So if people are having a lot of issues sleeping and their cell phone sitting right by their head, you know, the first hack is put it in airplane mode and move the phone way away from you. So if you absolutely need to use your phone as an alarm, if you can, put your phone in airplane mode and put your phone way across the room. But again, the other thing about cell phone alarms is that ideally you should not have a snooze function on your alarm. There's multiple reasons why, but you know, from a heart standpoint, is that, you know, that awakening, you know, to a loud noise, you know, raises cortisol, increases, you know, adrenaline, and puts slight, or, you know, slight stress on your heart. You know, if you hit snooze and you're going to go back to sleep for 10 minutes, now you're going to get startled awake again in 10 minutes. So you're just basically conditioning the heart to be under stress chronically. So, you know, if you optimally could, you would never even have an alarm clock. You would just wake up because your body's circadian rhythms were working well enough that you'd wake up. But in the modern day, some people got to be a place at a certain time. So if you're going to set an alarm, set it, but don't put the snooze button feature in it.
Okay, so I've been experimenting with this for a while now. And I, you know, for several weeks, I got up and I saw the sunrise and I was like, okay, this is going to be amazing. And then there are SNPs, right, that can be tied back to, I've got to do some more digging on myself is where I'm going with this, because I feel like when I don't set an alarm, I naturally wake up around 9 a.m. and I function optimally until about 1 in the morning.
All right.
Am I just an oddball?
Not necessarily. I mean, there are certain people who have a genetic predisposition that, you know, they're not going to be morning type people, but, you know, yeah. And if you're somebody who's already currently waking up at 9 o'clock, getting up to see the sunrise at 7 a.m., you know, making a 2-hour jump is not going to be, you know, feel real great for you. So, you know, if you're going to start scaling back the time that you wake up, do it in like 20-minute increments until you can get back there, and then be consistent. Once you're consistent, it gets a whole lot easier. It's when people are switching around their wake-up times that it gets much harder to get back up early again. But, you know, if you're already really controlling your light environment, you know, you see the morning sun, you get sun exposure throughout the day. When you're indoors, you protect your eyes and also should protect your skin from a lot of artificial light because it's setting off different pathways as well. And then at night, once it's dark, you would have only been exposed to, you know, fire, so red light. So, you know, you can go hardcore like a biohacker and, you know, deck out your house in red lights, but ideally it's no lights and, you know, protect your eyes with the glasses. And, you know, within an hour or so of bed, switch from your yellow tinted glasses to the red ones. And if you still say, like, that's not working for me, I'm going to be a night owl, then maybe you do have a SNP that does that. But that's only a couple percentage of people. The greatest majority of people, if they control their light environments, will have a normal circadian rhythm, sun up to sun down.
Well, I'm keeping at it, and it's getting better and better. But it's just one of those things where I was like, wow, what is going on with this? It's very interesting.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay, for people that are waking up in the morning, they're still just a little tired, and they're going, okay, I need to see if I'm getting better sleep. You know, am I getting enough deep sleep? You know, what are some ways that you can track that?
Sure. So the, you know, the first thing is, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you know, how do you feel? Give yourself, you know, a scale 1 to 10. You know, if it's a 10, I feel great and go out, do what I need to do today. You know, yeah, it might take a couple minutes for you to feel that, but if it's a couple hours and you feel like I got to, you know, drink a whole pot of coffee to be able to, you know, function, then you probably did not get quality sleep. If you want to track, probably in my mind, in this, you know, personal opinion, is, you know, the Oura Ring. Oura is a very good sleep tracker. There's another company called BioStrap. I've not yet had experience with them, but they'd be able to actually measure your different phases of sleep. So your stage one, stage two, stage three sleep, the non-REM sleep, and also the REM. And you're really wanting to shoot for, you know, 20-25% of your sleep being REM, 20-25% of your sleep being deep sleep. And sometimes the hack is that the sleep cycles are 90 minutes long. Plan your wake-up time and then backtrack when you should go to bed, but do it in like 90-minute increments. So, you know, most people should be sleeping, you know, 7 to 8 hours. You know, if you need to, you know, if you need more because you're sick, fine. But very few people are going to operate functionally well long-term with less than 6 hours. So 6 hours is 4 cycles, 7.5 hours is 5 cycles. So shoot for that.
Gotcha. All right. And very quick little touch on caffeine. You mentioned if you're having to drink a pot of coffee.
Sure. So caffeine is a drug. It's the number one drug of choice of most people. And you do ideally probably need to know what your SNP is if you're a fast or slow metabolizer of caffeine. Because if you're a slow metabolizer of caffeine, it's going to affect your sleep negatively. If you're fast, you probably can get away with it, but you should still ideally be stopping caffeine 10 a.m., noon at the latest, because about half the amount of caffeine will be in your system when you're trying to go to bed. And it, you know, keeps you alert because it's blocking the adenosine receptor from getting binded by the actual adenosine. And so you don't have that sleep pressure as much, but then when the caffeine wears off, then you have the big crash.
Great information. All right, Dr. Michael Twyman, how can people get in touch with you or follow you again?
Sure. So my website is apollocardiology.com, and I'm active on Instagram at Dr. Twyman. I'm also on Facebook, same thing, Dr. Twyman.
Awesome. And if anyone is interested in health coaching, I am offering one-on-one coaching through Dr. Twyman's program at Apollo Cardiology. So reach out to us. We would love to help and support you in your health journey. You're just such a wealth of information. I'm so honored to get to work with you and to have you on the show again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me again. It's wonderful, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this has been Amanda LaPlante. You've been listening to Get Real to Heal on KWRH LP 92.9 FM. For more information from me, check me out at amandalaplante.com. Be sure to sign up for my newsletter. We've got a lot of great information on that every single month. And you can also follow this and other episodes of Get Real to Heal at soundcloud.com/Get Real to Heal or Facebook.com/Get Real to Heal. Go make it a great day.